This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Are you worried that your child seems to have an abnormal walking gait, flat feet, or some condition related to the hip, foot, or musculoskeletal system? You might want to think twice before subjecting your child to procedures like MRI scans or the use of certain devices and whether these are really necessary for your child. So we have in the studio with us today two consultant orthopedic surgeons. Not one, but two. Dr. Rajesh Singh and also Dr. Muhammad Nawar Arifin, who's actually a consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon. And together we'll be discussing some common orthopedic procedures and tests that may be deemed unnecessary for children. So if you have any questions, call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon, Dr. Rajesh and Dr. Nawar. How are you both today?
Good, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm very good. Thank you.
Okay. So I came across this topic when I saw that the American Academy of Pediatrics had published, actually last year, a list in the United States Choosing Wisely campaign. So they chose to publish a list related to pediatric orthopedic procedures. But overall, this Choosing Wisely campaign is one that seeks to promote conversations between patients and doctors about appropriate and necessary treatment within the healthcare system. Dr. Rajesh, what do you think of a campaign like this?
Okay, look, when you first mooted this this sort of topic, I had to think a little bit about what's the single most important investigation that a child with a pediatric orthopedic condition could have. And after quite some thinking, I thought, look, why don't I just bring one into the studio? So I brought with me a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, which to me is the most useful tool that we have in sort of assessing pediatric orthopedic conditions.
So in your practice, Dr. Rajesh, I mean, what proportion of pediatric cases do you deal with?
Okay, probably about 10%. So 10% of my practice will be sort of common things that happen in children. And there's sort of certain developmental things that happen commonly. And, you know, we know it's common because we're trained in general orthopedic training for it. But there's also the sort of spectrum of common that you go, oh, this kind of doesn't look so common anymore. And then really the question comes, what should happen to this child? And I generally tend to refer to Dr. Nawar being a pediatric orthopedic surgeon because he has a wealth of experience accumulated by looking after children for a long time.
Actually, Dr. Nawar, can we get some idea of the process that takes you in terms of your qualifications? Because we're talking about a subspecialty, aren't we? Orthopedic, pediatric, you know, orthopedic. How have you gotten to this point?
Oh, it started in my university days when I discovered that I have a soft spot for children. I love to deal with them. At the same time, I like to also perform surgeries. To being a pediatrician, that is on the physician aspect of it, but being an orthopedic surgeon, I have the surgical part of it, plus that I have the ability or I have the opportunity to play and help those children. Of course, after the normal training of specialist course, then I continue with spending my time. At that time, I have the privilege to get to know our dearest, I think the longest ever serving pediatric orthopedic professors in the country, the late Professor Subir Singh Gupta. I have the privilege to be trained under him in the University of Malaya. And after that, to cut the story short, I spend my time in seeing those cases, continue the legacy of Professor Singh Gupta then.
Wow. And coming back to the idea of, you know, having these kinds of conversations about procedures that a patient, where a patient can be empowered to say, do I really need this? Can we talk a little bit about that idea first before we come into the specific to pediatric orthopedics? How important is that in your practice?
Wow. That's very important in my practice. You see, when the child got sick, I will say that the whole family got sick. This is how I usually term them as a syndrome of love. The parents would get agitated and they wanted to really know about the situation. They wanted to be clear about what's going on with their child. Compared to maybe an adult, God's sake, they're okay. You know, they go through the process. They are able to accept and proceed with whatever the treatment. But when it comes to their children, the adults, the parents especially, are a bit more cautious and they wanted to know to the great detail. It may involve with a sentiment of, you know, love, a sentiment that the child, they want the child to get better. They don't want any complication in the later part of their life. Or even if there is a serious consequences, they wanted to get the best and earliest treatment that they can. You know, the guilt and the preventive part of being parent is there. And not only that, sometimes the whole family, great-grandparents on both sides were also willing to come to my room, you know. So they just, this is what I call as syndrome of love.
Actually, it's interesting that you say that, Dr. Nawa. I recall a case recently. I was looking after an adult who had early osteoarthritis of the hip. So this gentleman had osteoarthritis of the hip, which was due to an old accident. And I treated him for a while, and then he ended up having a hip replacement in his early 50s. But then one day I get this sort of panic call from the family saying now his two-year-old son has hip pain and the child can't walk.
Yeah.
And that sort of disproportionate panic that the family had, which is, oh my God, what do we, you know, do we need to do an MRI? Do we need to do a PET scan? What scan do we need to do to know what's going on here? And that's usually very difficult to sort of temper.
Yeah.
So then what you probably see then is, especially within your patient cohort, is parents and families choosing to be overly enthusiastic, shall I say, about agreeing to a whole battery of procedures so that they can get peace of mind?
It is.
So then how do you manage that, right?
I always notice that everyone, including the child, including the sick patient, provided maybe they're around the age of one onwards, they're very sensitive about who is their caretaker. The parents and the patient are very sensitive about how do you approach them. It's about the trust and the level of confidence that you have to deal with my sick child. That's, you know, within the parents. And for the child themselves, you have to understand that when a sick child is sick, they don't have anyone else in their life to be trusted upon. They only look at their parents. And when they saw, they can have the feeling that the parent is trusted, is trusting this particular doctor or another person in their life, that is actually the first sign that they started to allow you to give trust and allow you to come into their surrounding, to examine them, to touch them. Once that happened, then everybody will be happy. So in my dictionary, what I always say is the level of confidence, the level of knowledge, the level of skills that you need to deal with the children. And many of the parents, they started to see when you are able to touch your child and the child started to play, the child started to smile to you, you know, that sort of another confidence to the parents. It is a very unique relationship in the room. It's not just about the disease itself. It's about the introduction, the initiation of the trust, and from there we proceed onwards.
Okay.
I think I remember the days when I trained with Professor Sen. I think one of the problems that we had in sort of those days were the clinics were relatively very sterile. You had this sort of hospital with, you know, hard benches, waiting rooms full of sick people, crowded, noisy, maybe even smelly. You know, some person may be in pain, some person may be crying. And, you know, to bring children into that environment, it never really struck me as sort of an optimal environment to be in to sort of examine a child. I understand you work at a specific women's and children's hospital. Do you sort of have better facilities there?
Yeah. The environment provide a good introduction at least. Mm-hmm. Then you don't only depend on your capability, on your own self. You know, you have a lot of support from the environment, the nurses, the decoration.
What do you mean decoration?
You see, children are very sensitive to their environment. As they are learning in life, We have to understand that for adult, we understand a lot of things already. There are so many inputs to our brain that make us to understand things behind the scenario. But for children, sometimes a small little thing can become so interesting, and that will become a learning material to them. So this type of environment, decoration to the room, the colors involved, you know, the sound that they're playing around, and of course, saying that, you know, they can still play while before they go and meet the doctor, that provide a different approach to a sick child.
And in terms of the consultation process, when it's a pediatric patient, I mean, how is that different? Because children can't perhaps tell you what they're experiencing in the way that adults can. So how would that typically look like when you have a child in front of you?
You have to look like he's my own children. You need to start examination and assessment even from the time that they started to walk into the room. And sometimes I make an effort to even open the room and see how they started to stand up from their sitting position in the waiting area. You see, children, they found it very difficult to follow instruction. They do not understand the whole process. I like you when I like you. I hate you when I hate you. Mm-hmm. That type of things. So you need to be strategic and smart enough to play and know what exactly that you are looking for. And of course, along the process, never ever break the trust of your children by creating first to have a trust from the parents. Now, then along the way, if this happens, I think the subsequently they are able, the child should be able to allow you to touch them, move their part, and of course you touch the painful area last, of course.
And I think also, Shaik, the sort of the focus of this topic is really appropriate investigations. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is, in pediatrics, most of the time, the most appropriate investigation is a repeat examination.
Okay.
And I don't just mean in terms of pediatric orthopedics. You know, my mum's a pediatrician, and even she would say this, that the most important investigation you can do is to lay your hands on the patients now, and then come again and lay your hands on the patients again and see what has changed. And I think in this sort of context of commercial medicine, where it is a fee-for-service and you've got third-party providers and things like that, that concept's really very difficult for people to understand, right? So the insurance company wants to know, very, very simple thing, the child's been in hospital for 3 days, what's the diagnosis? Now, I would turn around and say, well, the child's got a fever, the diagnosis isn't known yet, we're investigating, we think it may be at this, that or the other. Then the pressure will come, well, have you done an X-ray? Have you done an MRI? Have you done a CT scan? Have you done this? Have you done that? So it's sort of very frustrating when the payers don't understand that the most important thing that you can have is that repeat examination. And, you know, all these things that you can't put down on a piece of paper and have a charge code for. And I think that that's one of the messages that, you know, I really want to go out from today. The fact that when you talk about pediatric orthopedics, it's really an issue of old-style medicine already. I'll get children in the clinic who have flat feet. You know, the mother will show me her feet are flat. The father will show me his feet are flat. And the child will stand up and the feet are flat. And they say, oh, we're going to go get an MRI. We thought we'd just come and speak to you first. Mm. And, you know, I'm almost banging my head against a brick wall going, what is an MRI of a flat foot in a child with a history of parents with flat foot going to possibly show?
And there's the tension there where, of course, on the one hand, we start to mistrust a system that tells us you have to go for 10 different procedures and you're going to be charged X amount for this. But at the same time, we've come to a point where we expect instant answers from our healthcare providers, and we want something on an X-ray film or whatever it is that they can, you know, it's a visual confirmation.
Can go show your friends one.
So we're discussing today what may be some common orthopedic tests, procedures, or perhaps even devices that are prescribed to children but may not actually be necessary. And we kind of want to look at what could be the potential risks there and try to understand that. We have two consultant orthopedic surgeons in the studio, Dr. Rajesh Singh, of course, for his monthly show, but also consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Mohammad Nawar Arifin. We'll be right back after a few messages right here on BFM Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoik. In the studio with me today, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, and he's brought along consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Mohammad Nawar Arifin. We're talking about children and adolescents today, whether there are certain common tests and procedures that are being prescribed to children that perhaps may not be necessary. If you have any questions, you can call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Nawar, what would be some common conditions that you see among children that you think we should highlight today when it comes to some tests and procedures being over prescribed? Would that be
ordered?
Over ordered, that's right. Yeah. Some common conditions that you see in your clinic.
Yeah. It may be related to children's trauma, accident that happened at home, around school or workplace, shopping centers, you know. These are the common presentation, common fractures and joint injuries. But in my setup, I think the talking about any particular investigation that is being over ordered, I do not have that many experience except for X-rays. Mm. So you have to understand that sometimes in pediatric setup, the only thing that I need is X-rays. Once a while, then I go to a CT scan or MRI. Maybe if the child being or seeing different physician or caretaker before, you know, if they are in doubt or they do not know what is the condition, maybe they started to over investigate the child. But in my setup and in the way I look at things is proper assessment in children. Majority they give you the direct answers. Only a very little pathology that you need to go into the further investigation more than X-rays.
So how do we delineate then a proper assessment, what comes under that, and then what would necessitate, you know, moving on to more advanced?
Okay, so let me give you an example of a child who presented to me. So this child had fallen down, had seen and had elbow pain, and had gone to see the tita. And so the tita had sort of, you know, pulled it back into place and put a splint on it. Mm-hmm. And the child was sent to me with an X-ray, and the X-ray showed an obvious fracture. So in an adult, the next step would have been to do something like a CT scan to sort of delineate greater the extent of the fracture. But because this child, I looked at the fracture and I looked at the child and I said, look, you know, this is probably not something very straightforward. It should be dealt with by somebody's specialist in children. So I sent it to Dr. Nawar, and maybe Dr. Nawar can tell us what happened with that particular case.
Yeah, this is a typical lateral condyle, Dr. Rajesh. A lateral condyle fracture is unique in children in which it looks like a normal fracture in the X-rays. It can be easily detected, but the treatment is totally different. It can be acceptable in adults sometimes to treat conservatively, meaning put a cast in, do not need to perform surgery. And even the surgery, sometimes we can just fix through wires percutaneously. But in this particular case, because we know that it is a lateral condyle, we know that it is unique, it is always intra-articular, and it always displaced. And we have to open, straight away perform an open surgery and fix. And that fixation must also stay longer than before, than usual. This is an example to show that a unique condition in pediatric orthopedics can only be detected if the caretaker knows and have seen the similar case before. But if we do not, we are unsure, then probably we have a tendency to actually go for CT scan or MRI to get it further. But in children, if you understand the uniqueness of certain condition, you do not need all that. You just need to go in straight and perform the procedure.
And I think that's the key. I think that pediatrics, the term pediatrics actually means care of the bent child. So pedis being child, orthos being straight. So when the sort of area of when the area of orthopedic surgery began, till about probably the 1890s, it was exclusively for the care of children, right? But then once we worked out how to pin and plate and fix fractures, the sort of care of pediatric orthopedics quickly diverged into sort of trauma surgery and trauma care. So I like to sort of make the example of adult orthopedics is perhaps a little bit more like carpentry, right? Whereas pediatric orthopedics is a lot more like gardening. You really have to tend to your plants, watch them, see how they respond, and then tend to them again. So there's sort of minor adjustments which are made. But also there's certain things that you recognize being in your garden as, you know, this is a snail, this snail's going to eat all my saplings, I need to get rid of the snail. You can't just say, oh, it's just another creature in the garden. So pediatric orthopedics does have its sort of unique, very unique aspects within orthopedics. And especially when you're talking about ionizing radiation. So this is the thing we haven't really sort of spoken about. What is the harm in doing a CT scan in a child versus what is the harm in doing a CT scan in an adult? We know that radiation exposure in children should be limited. We know that higher radiation exposure, even through investigations, even with the modern investigations, even with the lower doses of radiation, are not particularly good for children. But, you know, we have to stop the pendulum from swinging the other end where parents say, oh no, I'm worried my child will get cancer, I don't want an X-ray, when an X-ray is clearly indicated. So the total cumulative dose of radiation in a child is something that should be taken into consideration. The anatomic variance in children as they grow is another thing that really has to be taken into consideration. And the child's skeleton is not a mini adult skeleton, right? So whenever you do an investigation in a child, even with an X-ray, there are some bones or areas of bones which are missing. And you need to know the facts that by this age, this area of bone should be there. And remember, that's one of the things that I struggled with during my training. You know, I'm looking at an X-ray going, okay, now I've got to guess the child of an X-ray. You got to guess the child's age based on this X-ray. But if you're a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, that stuff's off the hat for you because you already know that.
Right. And I mean, so with the use of radiation, it should be limited in children. But what about surgery itself? I mean, how many parents would want to put their children under the knife anyway? And how cautious would you be in recommending surgery for children?
Okay. This is a good introduction to my previous discussed case, that there are certain situations where it can be treated conservatively without surgery in adult, but must be operated in children. But at the same time, I have to also mention that many a case that children, you do not need to operate, while in the adult cases that you definitely need to go and do the procedure. This is maybe contributed by the great healing potential in children, and how the nature of the physiological nature of the children's bone and musculoskeletal system. For example, that if you have fractured radius or ulna, fracture of the forearm, distal radius is the commonest fracture in the world. In adult, if we have to fix if it is, you know, beyond certain degree, safe enough to say that at 30 degrees, you no way that you will accept 30 degrees angulation in the distal radius in adult. But in children, I can accept up to 30 degrees because I know there is such a potential great remodeling in children. That's the example. But talking about surgery, rather than approaching the clinical jurisdiction to go for the surgery, I would say that the decision for the surgery lies really on the trust between the caretaker and the parents. If there is a need to go for surgery, and the parents will usually evaluate that. If we do really have a clinical answer to that, and we relate this to the danger or to the need, real need for the child, usually they do not have any problem. I repeat, in my practice, or in pediatric orthopedic setup, trust between the system along the process is always a priority, and you have to maintain that with the patient and also to the parents.
You also mentioned flat foot earlier, Dr. Rajesh. So how do you manage something like that? And you do see a lot of products, orthotics being marketed to help children, you know, I don't deal with the condition. So what are your thoughts about that?
There are many pediatric orthopedic conditions that can be treated conservatively. And this conservative management includes orthosis, special foot, special shoe, other than surgical correction. But having said this, there are also many conditions that need to be assessed first by a professional, by us. Then only we decide whether this really need a shoe or really need the intervention. Many a times, you don't even need that. I had many in my practice that, you know, people nowadays, you know, that people look into the doctors of Google and, you know, mm-hmm. Auntie Yahoo. They ask when they read the internet and they started to imply or apply that to their children. And when they come to see me, I usually need to elaborate again. And many times I found that they do not need to go for the special shoe. I have a child who has been on a special shoe since birth. Wow. Because of the deformity of the foot, and somehow he has been wrongly advised. He was wearing the special shoe, keep increasing in size. They keep buying the special shoe, CTAV shoe, Dennis Brown shoe, Dr. Rajesh, for your information. While the child is up to 3 years old, and he was still walking with that special shoe. I came and I found that that's totally normal foot. And when I flipped through the notes, I discovered that, you know, based on the history, it was a calcaneal valgus rather than a CTEV. A calcaneal valgus is a condition that looked terribly bad at birth. The feet of the child looks doesn't look nice at all. But we know that it's going to go away and the child will walk normally. So they can be easily mistaken to the nearby friend, which is actually CTEV, where we really need an intervention, repeated serial casting and so on.
So in a situation like that, what's the impact of a child wearing a special shoe that's unnecessary? Could there be harm?
Oh, I love deflection, because I discovered that in children, there is great ability for them to adjust. You know, even he has been working like that, but still with that unnecessary shoe. But, you know, upon the next few follow-up, the child walks normally again. Because in children, they grow, they adapt to the situation. They are very, they know how to deal with whatever that they have.
Dr. Now, I think my sort of objection to that scenario is the financial cost that that puts on the family.
Yeah.
Because I've seen sort of patients walk in with, you know, 500, 600 ringgit pair of shoe that they've bought for their child, which is completely unnecessary. Mm. That, you know, they've been sold and wholeheartedly believe that I have to budget to be able to buy one of these every 3 months or 6 months.
Yeah.
Or when the shape of my child's foot grows big. And I think that's probably harmful in that way. Yeah. You know, the child may recover physiologically, but I don't think it's sort of reasonable for the marketplace to sort of have that out there without a message like this sort of correcting the view that get a professional opinion if specialized footwear is actually needed. And if it's not needed, then, you know, spend the money on a holiday.
Yeah, because a lot of, well, at least as far as the special shoes are concerned, they're available in retail outlets. Mm. And so if they're not, I don't know, regulated as medical devices, there's potential for a lot of these mistakes to occur.
Which happens every single day.
Okay. And so, you know, would there be extreme cases where it's caused irreparable harm? I've put Dr. Nawar in a spot.
Yeah.
I guess I'm trying to get at, okay, cost, yes, that is a significant burden.
Yeah.
But beyond that, what's the impact?
You see, I would love to go back to my original statement in the early part of our interview that when a child is sick, the whole family is sick. You see that the impact of a sick child in the family that made the parents or the other members of the family not to just sit down and accept. Usually, there is a very high tendency for them to ask for second or even third opinion. And then, you know, there is a sense of intuition, especially the mother's intuition, which is always correct about whether the child is right, being treated right or wrong, you know. So I usually trust the mother's intuition, where, especially when we are doing along this the prolonged treatment. But to answer to your question, I think it's very rare, because they're usually the family members, the parents are not happy when the things are not been living like that. They want to see immediate progress. And being a child, they have great recovery, they have great healing potential. They usually progress very well. And within a certain time, they can see the results.
But I think there's another side to that sort of family equation and dynamic as well. I remember one of my very early cases, which I was quizzed on as a trainee, was this, it was in November, and the child was 6 years old, turning seven, and the child was a girl from the community who had a club foot. Now, a club foot is a deformity of the foot, which happens at birth, and the foot is deformed, and the foot needs to be treated either by serial application of plaster casts or by surgery, and that usually happens at birth. Now, the question which I was asked was, why is this female child coming to seek treatment? She lived in the city, not in the jungles or not in the periphery, at 6 years of age in the month of November. Now, I was completely flawed as to, I have no idea. And the answer is because before the age of seven, it's not mandatory for the child to go to school.
Mm.
In January, this child is going to go to school.
Mm.
So the family who have ignored this sort of inconvenient deformity suddenly now has an urgency to treat the deformity before the child is exposed socially. So the social aspects, I think, cut both ways, both in terms of what treatments the family may find inconvenient, just as much as what treatments the families actively seek out.
And what happens in a case like that, where there could potentially, the girl could have potentially missed out on, I don't know, 6 years of intervention?
They blame the doctor.
All right.
So this is because this is the classic history that I got.
We all love to do that,
yes,
don't we?
So and that was why having Prof. Sen around was such an amazing thing, because I took the history from the family. I said, you know, the child was born, the deformity was noted, a cast was applied, and after changing the cast twice, the doctor said, you don't need to apply the cast anymore. So I went and I presented this history to my professor. And he looked at me and he had this method of carrying you by the elbow, just sort of hold you by the elbow and just sort of take you around like you're on a leash. And he took me to the patient's bedside and he asked the parents, what is the name of the doctor who treated you? So they gave the name. And he said he was both my medical student as well as my orthopedic student. I did not teach him to do such a thing. And then the penny drops for the parents. They say, oh, well, you know, he said, maybe if you want, we can come back. But, you know, it's very inconvenient to go to the hospital every week and get the cast change. And, you know, the child was running around with their siblings. And, you know, so we thought it was not necessary. Right. So in that sense, the family had only come to the conclusion later that they had robbed her of a good clinical outcome by their negligence. And they weren't able to accept that. Right. So it was easier to blame the system rather than to sort of accept responsibility. But the thing I love about that is, like all of pediatric orthopedics, it's about a deep and profound knowledge of the natural history. Natural history means what happens if you do nothing? What happens if you do A? What happens if you do B? Now, that's important in all areas of medicine, very important in orthopedics, but profoundly important in pediatric orthopedics, which is what will the growth trajectory of this child be if I do nothing?
Mm.
And, you know, here we have the sort of doyen of pediatric orthopedics going, he was my medical student and my orthopedic student. I wouldn't have taught him that.
Okay.
So that was sort of, it just reinforced it on so many levels.
Yeah. So that's what we're discussing today, you know, the virtue of doing nothing over doing a lot of tests, yes, and a lot of procedures, yes, for pediatric orthopedic patients. We have in the studio with us Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, and Dr. Muhammad Nawar Arifin, consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon, sharing those thoughts with us. If you have any questions, call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've had a couple of questions and comments come in. We'll get to them after the market update right here on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. In the studio today, consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh, as well as consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon Dr. Muhammad Nawar Arifin. We are discussing whether children really need the whole battery of orthopedic tests that are usually ordered, or that may be commonly ordered to investigate certain conditions or procedures that may be prescribed for them. We have a question on Twitter from Chiang, who's asking about his 12-year-old daughter who was born with her right foot pointed inward, and he wants to know where he can seek treatment.
Dr. Nawar, sounds like it's right up your alley.
Yeah. I wanted to really know whether it is a 12-year-old or 12 months old. It has to be 12 years old, right? There's a few condition with foot pointing inward. Especially when it happened after 12 years old or at 12 years old. I have to really elaborate. I have to really assess the child and see whether this inward foot is really originated at birth as what she pointed. There are certain conditions that maybe started much later. But even if it started at birth, meaning that there are something that we need to evaluate and have to see. It may not be just the foot. It may started from the knee. There's something, there are condition that's also in the hip area that may lead to foot pointing inward. My humble advice is just get to any pediatric orthopedic surgeon and get them assessed for you.
Okay.
So you don't need an X-ray. Let's start with that, right? So you don't need an X-ray, you don't need a CT scan, you don't need an MRI, you need a competent assessment.
All right. We also have a comment on WhatsApp from Indrani. She says she was diagnosed with osteochondritis desiccans more than 3 decades ago. This was in her school years. She says, I remember as a child a long period of having to wear knee braces on both legs and how awfully ashamed she felt at having them peek out from below her school pinafore skirt. But her parents had explained that the doctor didn't want her to use a splint or metal brace that might have helped a quicker recovery, but instead a cloth brace because it would be more comfortable for her and perhaps more social acceptance in terms of going to school and all that. And so she says, the awkward teen in me should be forever grateful.
Yeah.
I mean, how much flexibility is there, especially when it comes to children and adolescents, in terms of managing what would be comfortable for them in their daily lives as well?
Yeah, that, she pointed a very important approach of in pediatric orthopedics, when we have to consider not only the different part of social improvement life, especially when you get involved with teenagers and adolescent time, but it's also much earlier. Let's take a case of developmental dislocation of the hip. When the child was born with the hip is outside the socket. When the child is below 1 year old, below 6 months, we do have a certain set of procedure or things that we can be done in order for the child to, in order for us to so-called settle the case before 1 year old. Why we do that? Because we knew at 1 year old, the child will start walking and they need to have the head of the femur in the socket so that the child can start walking normally. These are the special consideration in pediatric orthopedic where we take into consideration every aspect of growth, especially from the musculoskeletal aspect of it from the beginning. And also when the child get involved to go to school. In Malaysia, for example, they started schooling about 5 and 7 years old. We knew that, you know, any intervention, any surgical correction, if possible, we wanted to do before that age, before the child reached that age. The main reason is because we want the child to have a school duration without any surgical intervention during that time, because easily it can, any bony procedure can easily take about up to 3 months for the full recovery before the child can go back to school.
And that would disrupt.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, in that list that they published under their campaign, did highlight that they don't recommend hip ultrasound for hip dysplasia or dislocation. Can you help put that into perspective for us?
Yeah, these are the case of dislocation of the hip, developmental dislocation of the hip. Thank God that it's becoming rarer. We don't used to see those diseases nowadays compared to before. I do not know the particular reason why, but I started to see less and less in our practice. There are certain prevalence countries and area where the dislocation of the hip becomes prominent. But having said that, in the case, in the early case, at birth, usually the doctors will perform thorough screening, specific assessment to exclude this condition. And if sometimes they found a situation where, you know, this is the famous Ottolani and Balu test, you know, and when they have that specific positive test at birth, usually the child will be subjected to our follow-up, pediatric orthopedic follow-up. And in the initial part, we used to do ultrasound to make sure to determine whether the head of the femur is really inside the socket, the ball and socket joint. But the discovery is ultrasound is usually an operator dependent skills. A different assessor will provide different results. That's number one. Number two, in pediatric age group, usually less than 1 year old, the anatomy and the development of the bone is not as clear as to adults. This is usually giving more harm to a parent, because they get you rather than you solve the problem by giving a definite answer, then usually you give a lot more undefined answer. Another example that correlate with this example, with this situation, is like screening that we used to do for scoliosis in children. We discovered that the more we found mild form of scoliosis, they actually lead to a lot more depression among the adolescent, rather than we found the bad curve that we can treat surgically.
So we used to do screening for scoliosis.
We used, but now
routinely.
We stop that.
Okay.
Look, if I can share my experience of this exact same thing, this is when I was training in New Zealand and I was in the pediatric orthopedic clinic, and this exact same scenario. So child has been assessed by the routine antenatal screen as having an unstable hip. The child is referred to the pediatric orthopedic clinic. From the pediatric orthopedic clinic, I duly referred to the radiology department. The radiology department duly did an ultrasound, and I read the ultrasound report when the parents came back, and I said, everything looks fine. I did not examine the child.
Right.
Now you see where the problem's going to go. 6 months later, because the ultrasound had said that the hip is in place, instead of seeing the child at 1 month later, I saw the child at 6 months later. And at 6 months later, we had lost 5 months of an opportunity to treat. So the harm done there is the false reassurance given by a normal ultrasound at the time. Because the message there should really be that the key to an unstable hip is the surgeon's hands. Can the surgeon dislocate the hip and pop it back in? If the answer is yes, then by definition, the hip is unstable, regardless of how strong the surgeon is. If he can't, then the hip is stable by definition. So it really goes back to that repeated examinations and surgeon's hands again, as opposed to an investigation.
And that's why you feel so strongly about, you know, looking to imaging scans. Just looking solely to those for an answer.
Correct. And, you know, I give my acronyms again, VOMIT, which is Victim of Medical Imaging Technology, and BAF, Brainless Application of Radiological Findings. So in that instance, I was guilty of BAF.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but can I get you both to leave us with a final message to really, it's all about perspective when it comes to how parents and families can manage orthopedic conditions in their children. So perhaps Dr. Nawar, a message from you.
Yeah, never ever see a child as a small adult. They are not small adult. They grow. They can't make decision for themselves. They depend on us to consider on their behalf whenever they have any problem. And they are not small mini version of us. They have totally different physiological, pathological, and in that sense, get a proper assessment. Get to the real person who can actually provide you some direction when you are dealing with your child.
Dr. Rajesh?
Avoid bath and vomit.
In more ways than one.
Yes.
If you want to find out more about children's health issues, we are organising our annual Health and Living Junior event that's happening this Saturday on the 5th of October. We'll be talking about things like allergies, vaccination, and what's most pressing on parents' minds today, how to prepare our children adequately to face the future as adults. We'll also have a whole load of kids' activities as well, like storytelling and yoga for kids within safe limits, of course. if you'd like 2 free tickets, text us now with your full name and email address, and we'll get back to you with those complimentary tickets. We've been talking to Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, and Dr. Muhammad Nawar Arifin, consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon, about whether children really need those orthopedic tests. Thank you very much for joining me. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.